So I'm going to try something different tonight. My talk title tonight is the same as Matthew Daniel's talk, Reflections and Discussion on Practice. I've been giving talks often 6 a year here for about 12 or 13 years, and until tonight, they've been very prepared. I'm almost obsessed about what I was going to say and what points I'm trying to make. And for some reason, I won't speculate why I decided to just come in here and have no idea what I'm going to say. So keeping in mind Winston Churchill's, one of his famous quotes, "Success is not final and failure is not fatal," I've decided to take the gamble here. And I hope this is beneficial to everyone. I think part, just really want to be more intimate rather than having a very structured agenda. And I was sitting up here and thinking, I wish I knew what was going on in all these minds and what people thought practice was about and how to do it and where it was going to get them. I reflecting over the last 30 years, just thinking about what ideas I came with when I first came to practice. And how much they seem to change every 3 years about what practice is and what it's about. It's a really, I think it's a complex path, a complex way to even understand what we're trying to achieve and how to go about it. And there's all kinds of techniques that are offered. So I was at Whole Foods today, and I was checking out, and there was a magazine called Mindful Exercise. And then there's a subtitle, there's an article that said, "How to Lose Your Belly and Yourself." So I don't know how many people want that, but looks like most people here don't really need to lose their belly, but maybe their self would be helpful. So this word mindful has just, seeped into all kinds of Western teachings, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, da 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 da. I mean, it's like this kind of Ajahn Tanisaro actually was talking about. He was flying out here and he's on an airplane, and the magazine had all these articles about mindfulness. And he said, "Well, it's kind of like this magic salve that you put on yourself, and it cures everything. It makes you more attractive, sexier, loving." Brilliant, whatever. I mean, it's just amazing. So, it's just really interesting to ask your question, like, what are your aspirations and what do you really believe is going to come out of this practice and how to get there and really whether what you're doing is going to get you there. This is interesting to give a talk where you have no idea, this stream of consciousness thing. There's a guy, there's a really famous discourse called the different teachers pronounce it different ways. Some people call it the Bahia Sutta. Some people call it the Baya Sutta. It's one of the most famous discourses in the Theravadan tradition, which is this place has kind of been founded on. And the story is Baya kind of thinks he might be awakened, and he kind of wondering and. So this is Devata, which is kind of a minor god or goddess, says, not only are you not awakened, you're not even on a path to becoming awakened. And then he goes to Buddha and asks for instructions. And the way the story goes, that he goes to Buddha and he says, I please teach me. And the Buddha says, "No, I'm on alms round. I can't teach you." And he said, but you could die anytime and I could die anytime. Please teach me." He said, "No, I can't do it." And then he says, "I'm on alms round." And so the third time he asked him, apparently this is a key thing to know if you ever run into a Buddha, that if you ask him 3 times, he has to answer. So this is a really short version. People have given a whole talk on this discourse, so I've always liked to compact things. And he says, "Well, you should practice like this. In the seen, there's only the seen. In a herd, there's only the herd, and so on with all the sense experiences. In a cognized, there's only cognized. And in this discourse, the story is that Bahia, or Baya, depending on your choice, awakens immediately. Actually, a good friend of mine who's, I guess he's 52, 53 now, he's just really a brilliant teacher, he's had so much influence on me, and he's had pancreatic cancer for a couple of years, getting extreme chemo, and he got over it, and now I got an email, I guess last week, that the cancer's come back, and he's probably going to die within a year, but he used to be here. He was in the Experience Yogi group, and I sat with him in England for 3 months, and just an amazing guy, and the way he has been dealing with his, you know, pancreatic cancer and Crohn's disease, that just is such an inspiration. And I think it's just amazing what this practice can offer. That's my own experience as well. It's just such a gift, and I hope every one of you in here has the faith and determination and skill to get those same gifts. But anyway, he would tell a story about it. He'd hear these discourses on Bahia and sort of hope that, well, you know, maybe he'll awaken when he hears it. You know? Because this only thing is really big. What does that mean? I mean, when I rang the bell at the end of the sitting, I said, can there just be the hearing? And what I meant by that is that can there not be anyone outside the experience? Actually, last week, Doug Phillips gave a talk, and he called it, What is Awakening and Do You Really Want It? And there's no real agreement on awakening. I'm really interested in hearing Doug's talk because I have immense respect for him as a teacher. But there's all kinds of kind of disagreements about what awakening is. But I think one really key aspect is seeing through the sense of self. This actually to not separate, not trying to push things away, not try to get things, to be able to open and at peace with things exactly the way they are right now. And that's a skill to be learned. I've had some health issues and something that really triggered me over the last month and a half, and it's just amazing what a gift it is to have this practice. And so one thing I think that I guess what I like to encourage people, whether they're new or have been practicing for a long time, is to find a way in that's really joyful, that's really steady, that's a place of refuge for you. And you know, what is offered here and other places are simply techniques, different ways in. Okay, and I encourage you, there's, you know, usually what gets taught here is being with the breathing process, sometimes metta practice, loving kindness practice, which actually can be both a cultivation of a particular way of being, as well as a concentration practice and an insight practice, that one can repeat these phrases over and over again with an intention to cultivate this quality of friendliness or kindness towards oneself and others. But it also, when one shortens the phrases and repeats them rhythmically, it's a great way to get a concentration practice. And it's also an insight practice in the sense you see all your little stuff, you know. I can't send metta to this person. That's for, and it's just something to open to investigate. So when we sit and do sitting meditation, that's not the end game. It's a way to get enough stability to be with what's happening, to do some sort of investigation. Excuse me, I'm jumping around a little bit. This is clearly stream of consciousness tonight. I want to do a few exercises. Before I do that, though, I want to maybe back up a little bit and we talk about what a direction of this path might be and sort of how to go about it. There's a book actually called Kama and the End of Kama. If you just Google it, it'll come up. There's a electronic version in various forms available. And there's 5 copies in the library, I think. It's written by John Suchito, who's one of my favorite teachers. And for me, it's been one of the really most helpful guides to what practice is about and how to go about it. So kama is the Pali word for cause and effect, and the Sanskrit is karma, which people probably have more of a sense of. And in a way, they're really very simple words. Karma or kama simply means actions. And the more we act in a particular way, the more we're inclined to act that way. So we have patterns of behavior. That makes sense? These patterns aren't our fault. They're a result of causes and conditions. If you reflect on that, we all got born into this world with a particular set of genes, a set of parents, a culture. Different things happen to us. We have different energy levels. Our minds work differently. And in a sense, we're perfect. Everybody in this room is perfect. You couldn't be any other way than you are right now. So I find that a very helpful view to take. And a lot of practice is about view and reflection. My good friend that I just talked about, pancreatic cancer, says that in a way, a lot of this practice is about a way of looking, a skillful way at looking at your life and seeing what ways of looking at life is uplifting, brings a sense of connection, of peace, and what ways close you down, separate, contract. So I use this particular reflection all the time. Doesn't it make it a little bit easier to be compassionate to yourself? It's like, well, all these things happen to me and I'm just like I am. I couldn't be any other way. And if you look at other people in the same way, wouldn't that be helpful? So you might think I do a lot of practice at Whole Foods, right? Because I was walking around Whole Foods before I checked out, and I'm looking at all these people who have all these different shapes and ages and mannerisms, and just, you know, reflecting on they're that way because of everything that happened to them and the way they unfolded. And I just think, may you be well. So that's a cultivation. That's a way to look at things. And it's just like really uplifting. It's cheerful. So maybe when you don't do things the way you think you should. Oh, causes and conditions. May I be well? Or may I care for myself? Rather than this inner tyrant, which is the major reason people suffer in this society. I don't know about other societies. I mean, this inner critic that tells you should try harder, be more, etc. To really carry around that kind of approach. So this kama and the end of kama is to develop these qualities of kindness, to actually deliberately cultivate them. And to sit with all the difficult stuff. And that's why we do this practice of samadhi, of calming, to have enough steadiness to be with it. Because that's how it gets released. This is very much an embodied practice. So I want to loop back a little bit to where I started about this word mindfulness. Mindfulness is a translation of a Pali word sati. Pali is the language that a textual language that the Buddha's teaching was written down in. There's actually in the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, or I call them four tasks, four things to do. It's actually called, there's a word samasati, which means right mindfulness. Or I prefer the translation Ajahn Tanisro gives it, harmonious mindfulness, rather than this right and wrong kind of thing. So that actually has an ethical component to it. It just doesn't just mean know what you're doing, but you do it for a way that has some ethics to it. And the ethics isn't so much about some morality, but that when you behave in a kind, compassionate way, when you're not greedy, don't want so much, it's uplifting. So there's a woman, she's a black lesbian Zen master, Sabine Selassie, and she wrote an article. She said, mindfulness, ugh. It's a word given to us by the Victorian era. And she said, along with other words like appreciative joy or sympathetic joy, I guess is what we get to hear a lot of times, right? And she said, well, why not bodyfulness? Or another teacher, who I love, is from South Africa, who talks about all her suicidal tendencies. So why not heartfulness, bodyfulness? So this practice isn't about being in the head, looking at things, observing. That word observing gets used a lot. And when I first came to practice, I was told that this practice was just mirror-like. You just saw things. But that's not empathic. Oh, is the microphone gone?
No.
It's not, it's too far away? Okay, well, thank you. Okay. So that's just really not empathic. So really the practice is an embodied practice. To notice how things feel. How they feel in the heart, how they feel in the body. And so when you perform actions in daily life, notice what it feels like when you're kind and compassionate. Know what it feels like when maybe something that you really don't want happening happens, and you say, oh, this is how things are right now. I had a Zen teacher said, everything's perfect. It couldn't be any other way. Like, we're all perfect. The situation's all perfect. He also said the universe doesn't care about your opinion. He wasn't talking to me directly, fortunately, but I took it in. So there is this cultivation of these skillful patterns, and a way to kind of encourage them is not just to think about you should be a particular way, but to get a felt sense of what it's like. You know, it's like this when I go down a whole, when I'm running around Whole Foods and just saying, may you be well. It's just like, wow, this is so nice. It's so much, and you know, the contact, you make eye contact, it's just really uplifting. And the other part is to kind of be with all these negative patterns, to have enough steadiness to release them, because they're embodied too. I have a trauma history. Part of the way to release trauma is to have the ability to open up to the experience without getting lost in it. So there's a guy, Peter Levine, who some of you may be familiar with, who does a lot of work with somatic experiencing, and he talks about two approaches. I can't remember the name of one, but I can describe what it is. One is called titration. And titration has this notion that if you have a chemical and you put it into something that's really large, a small amount of chemical doesn't have a big effect. So the titration notion is to be big. Because what happens when there's difficult experiences, the mind contracts around them. Have you ever noticed that? I remember one night I was giving a talk and a guy was just obsessed about his itchy nose. It was like his whole world had collapsed down to that. So part of the approach is to widen your awareness. Okay. A quote I really like by Joseph Goldstein, you know, all the stuff's going on, he says, and the sky is blue. Just to say that. I had my teeth cleaned this morning, and I have just the most wonderful dental hygienist in the world. She's just an absolute delight to be with, but it's still not pleasant. But sometimes it's pleasant, you know, in between breaks when we're having conversation, which is actually part of this impermanence thing. It's like we think that, you know, the mind contracts around things and everything seems horrible. But when you develop enough steadiness, you say, oh, well, it's not horrible every moment. The dental hygienist was not horrible every moment. There were a lot of really moments that were quite funny. Actually, they had this really crazy music going on. It was like they were playing Mac the Knife. Does anybody know that song? I mean, that was like in the 50s or something, right? I mean, like before, you know, when I was... even when I was young, you know. And I just started laughing. She said, yeah, sometimes it gets on these tracks. So life is kind of like that, where in the midst of all this crap that's going on, if you really get settled, really have a steady mind, you start saying, well, you know, every moment I'm not really depressed. Every moment I'm not really furious. Okay. So there's this fundamental approach of cultivating uplifting qualities, kindness, compassion, renunciation, which maybe we'll call simplification, just not wanting so much. And sort of seeing how when we, you know, somebody cuts us off. I was teaching a class, and this guy has been practicing for 30 years, said, this guy cut me off and I was chasing him. It just doesn't lead to peace, right? So you start seeing that, you're really paying attention to it. This doesn't take some like super concentration level. It's really a way of shifting our way of looking at the world. Now, in the insight meditation practice, I thought when I was sitting up here before I started talking, I wouldn't have much to say, and, you know, here I go. And Ryan said, I'm never a loss for words. So in this practice, the practice tends to be to pay attention to objects. That's usually what the teachings are, right? Maybe the notice bodily sensations coming and going, or thoughts coming and going, emotions coming and going. And it has some value, because when you see all this stuff's impermanent, there's kind of a dispassion to it. But Ajahn Sumedho, who is really one of the elder monks. He practiced Ajahn Chah in Thailand for a long time, and then he came to England and established a monastery, Chittaveka, and then he was an abbot at another monastery in England, Amavati, I guess it was. And, you know, in his later years, I guess he's 84, he's still around. He said, you know, I think that Vipassana meditation focuses too much on the object. So this is where I thought I was going to start my talk. So I'm finally there. What he said, rather than focus on the objects, what we should do more is focus on what knows the object. That should be our practice. And that, for me, is my refuge. So maybe just try and get a little way into that. Let me give an example here. So if I hold up this Kleenex box, you can notice its rectangular shape, right? And you can also notice its color. They're just two facets of the same thing. So in the same way, you can focus on the object, or you can focus on the knowing of it. And Joseph Goldstein teaches this quite a bit. John Sumato said that's really, he thought, what really would be a better, more skillful practice. I personally find it much more skillful. There's this quality of knowing. I mean, at first it might feel like a witness, but actually there's something that's this there all the time. It's subtle, but when you notice it, it's at peace no matter what's going on. And so for me, the inclination is more and more to go to that place rather than going to this crazy mind. I mean, it's improved a lot, actually. Probably go downhill soon because I'm getting pretty old, but it's just crazy. You know, it wants this, doesn't want that, da-da-da, you know? But this awareness, it's just, you could call awareness or stillness, it's simply there. I been teaching some daytime classes, and for a while, I'd have groups get together, maybe five or six people, and go around and describe what this quality of awareness is like. And the rules are something like, if it's about the past, if it's about the future, if it's about an object, you just give a whole lot of list of things that's a thing, that's not it. And I actually took a course, it wasn't a Buddhist course, where we did this for an hour and a half with six people for a couple weeks. And I thought, this is crazy. I'm being asked to describe something that's ineffable, that can't be described. But if you really trust this awareness to describe itself, it can do it. So I did this to groups, and every time there would be like three groups. One group would get totally lost, and two groups would say, oh, you know, we're in empties, we're just rolling, you know. And I finally decided to stop forcing people to do it. And the last class I did, I said, if you want to do this, show up early, reclining Buddha room will do it. And so we're going around, and this woman who was there started crying. And I was worried maybe some trauma had come up or something like that. And I said, are you okay? And she said, it's so vast. She'd really touched something. There's something that this is what's so crazy. It's like there. When I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I realized there was nothing to do. That all this effort we're doing is trying to get somewhere. And what we really need to be is be here right now. There's this peace here, readily available. So how do we maybe explore this a little bit? Just really come into your body. And you might simply explore how you know you have a body, perhaps feeling the pressure of the cushion under your buttocks or the chair or bench. The expansion of the body on the in-breath and the kind of dropping down, relaxing on the out-breath. And perhaps noticing how the energy level increases on the in-breath. And it drops down, relaxes on the out-breath. So, on the out-breath, just really letting the out-breath complete itself, letting the belly drop in the lap, the diaphragm relaxing completely. And this maybe turn your attention a little bit to the heart sense. If it's helpful, you can put one hand on the heart. Just how things feel for you right now. And you might notice any thoughts that are occurring. And also how they're just doing it all on their own. Just scanning through, find any place where there might be some tension. Sometimes simply turning your attention to it relaxes it, letting the eyelids and lips soften. I'm sorry, eyes and lips. And feeling the space around you. So without thinking, what is it knows all this? Knows thoughts, knows body sensations. Notice the sense of eye. Notice the sense of space. Sounds coming and going, all unfolding in this knowing quality. Emotions coming and going within this knowing quality. Bodily sensations. Just doesn't take any effort at all. The knowing happens all on its own. So we call this perhaps awareness. Or stillness. Ajahn Satchitu even called it spirit one time. So can this peace be available right here, right now? Okay. So when you're ready, open your eyes. And I want to offer another approach to looking at this. So this approach doesn't come from the Buddhist tradition. It comes from I can't remember the name of the guy, but there's a website called headless.org. Okay, headless.org. And a friend of mine, Dharma friend, really been struggling with practice for a long time, and she's an artist, very visual, and she started using some of the approaches, experiments on this headless.org, and just a profound shift took place for her. So I hope it happens for you tonight, or you can go to headless.org and play with this. And not only that, she met her current husband. on some of the get-togethers on the thing. So here's the experiment. Just point your finger at anything that you feel like pointing your finger at. It could be me, it could be the Buddha back behind me, or the wall, or the plant. And just do that, and just notice that you're looking at some object. So there's an object, and there's you looking. Now, maybe point the finger at your foot. Again, there's an object, and you're seeing it. Now, point at your chest. Okay. Now, point at your face. So what do you see? What other people think is your face, you don't see anything when you look at your face, do you? There is simply this clear, spacious, boundless awareness that's there, that everything unfolds in. Another way to kind of look at this is that I think I alluded a little bit to what I thought in some sense this practice is about being in awareness, just this quality of awareness itself. It's also about non-separation. So when the Buddha said, very famously, I teach only dukkha and the end of dukkha, this Pali word dukkha is usually translated as suffering or stress or dissatisfaction or inherently unsatisfactory. And, you know, you look at life, it's really, wow, what a trip, huh? I mean, I talk about this suffering and stuff for a long time, and I think I'm finally getting it at 75. Just the body falls apart, you know, it's just poor Claire, the assistant minister of the center, somebody hit her car today. It's just people get dementia. I'm getting my second colonoscopy in 6 weeks at the end of the month. I mean, that's pretty trivial stuff, right? But I mean, it's just really amazing how challenging it is. Where was I going with this? There's this awareness that's okay with it all, of not trying to line things up. And so it's a real skill to learn how to do that. But if, I was tempted to ask people to reflect on, I actually asked you to reflect on what you hope to get out of this practice. I think, for me, I would say, there's a lot of things, but two things that really strike me as really profound is, one, the sense of awareness, to just notice it's there at times. And when you start seeing it, just incline your mind to go there more, just to appreciate it. That when all the thoughts are firing away and the stories and stuff, just, oh, there's something aware. Can I be there with that? And let the stories go. Okay, the mind can chatter away, tell the story, the body can do all this stuff. And this awareness is simply there, ready to receive it. Narayan's got a new book out, a guiding teacher here. Well, she doesn't have it out. It's coming out January 22nd. It's called Magnanimous Heart. And it's very personal. I think it's just a beautiful book. I got an early copy because she wants people to review it before it comes out. She talks about her own personal loss and grief. And there's a page in it that just really struck me where she says, when you're really open to the grief and you realize that trying to hold on to something that you really can't hold on to anything, and you realize deeply you can't do that, then the things you lean against fall away. And there's a space And this space is this awareness I've been talking about. So part of the seeing all this changing nature of things is to kind of say, oh, well, it's just, you know, you go through all these things, you accomplish things, you know, you get in relationships, they fall apart, you know, you get a partner, it's really great for a while, and then it's not so great. You get a job, and then maybe the company goes bankrupt, and all these things come and go. They've been coming and going for me for 75 years now. And after a while, it's like the drama is kind of taken out of it. I mean, one of the things I do is teach the elders group, and there's this, these, what are called the five remembrances, which are reflections on the fact that we're all going to get old, sick, and die. Actually, I like decay rather than sick, because I'm not going to get young again. And sick, you might have some hope for recovery. And the fourth reflection is that, the way my teacher Ajahn Suchito described it, or he languages, everything is mine, beloved, and pleasing will become otherwise. And he gave his talk. I really love it. I can't remember the title of it. But in the talk, he says, why did the Buddha, straight-talking Buddha, say this? Is he trying to depress us? But what he said is, when the mind sees that everything breaks up, it sees into its true nature, which is awareness. So all this effort to get things, accomplish things, line things up, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. We should take care of ourselves, but they're just, if we don't have an attachment to it and realize there's something that's at peace right here, right now, and we start kind of inclining ourselves to be aware of that more and more, I think it's just a lovely refuge. So I thought maybe I'd have 20 minutes, but I've talked 45, so I think I'll stop here. And, you know, I've said a lot. I just think this practice is really tricky because there are all these techniques, and we all come with ideas about where it's going to get to and what we should be doing. And I've watched people, you know, 30 years, and they just have some idea that just, it's like, wow. and I don't know. In part, you know, part of it's the way it's taught. I mean, the first year I went out, my first year I lost my job midway through practice, and I took 6 weeks, went off to the mountains by myself, and I was really good at concentrating, so I thought it was just going to be, you know, 6 weeks of bliss, right? And every sitting, at the end, I'd feel like I just wanted to get up. And then I'd start crying. And I did that for, I don't know, 7 or 8 days. I thought, God, is it going to be like this for 6 weeks? But it was all in the body. All the stuff had to be released. So this is really part of our very difficult practice, is to develop the skill to be with these things without getting lost in it. Oh, actually, I was talking about the titration thing. The other thing is just to come in and out of it. So if it's too much, you get away from it, go back in it when you're okay. Right? So I'll stop there, and anything you ask has really got to be brilliant, because it's so easy to be deluded about this practice that I hope I can be of help some way.